plan to spend it in one place.
For now, here's the short list of the music I played. Started off with Time Song, a previously unreleased track by The Kinks. Workaround 2 by Beatrice Dillon. Gleaming by Emily Yacina. Say Hi did a MacBook Pro to a 90s Dell. We heard Flowers of Light by Caspian. Don't Look Down by And You Will Know Us from the Trail of Dead. Wistful by Baths. Forest Management did Magnolia. We heard The Fat Angel by Donovan. Requiem for a CS-70 in Strings by Floating Points. Jubilee did Disconnected. We heard 011538i by Dominic Vaccaro. Frail State of Mind by the 1975. First Wave by Francie Moon. Paying the Rent by Silvestri. And in the background now, that's Fool's Gold by Lucy Davis. And you've been listening to What's the Frequency, Kenneth? I'm Paul Fisher.
Let's open the door, see how many feel like drunks in a bathtub keep piling in. Now I'm locking the door till the morning. He'll blame the alcohol and you'll blame the phone. She'll blame the fall of men.
Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960. WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960. And you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Roberts. I saw you on Broadway. Many, many years ago. Play it again, Sam. What's the Frequency, Kenneth, with Paul Fisher, was brought to you on recording. This is, as Tony Roberts mentioned, WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Now, let's see if I can start my show without too many technical glitches. For a change.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning via Skype in just a few minutes will be Terrence Taylor, and he and I will be discussing some of the latest in media science fiction. We'll hear a reprise from Dan Persons as well. Stay tuned. Again, good morning. Happy New Year. The happy Yule. I don't think, well, let's see. If we're doing Yule by the Christian method, I think it ends on 12th night, which is January 6th. So the season really doesn't end until 12th night. So we've got a little ways to go. Let's see. So I'm in the new studio. Things are working out fairly well. There was a question when I was going on the air, but our control person, as it were, our engineer, not broadcast engineer, I do that myself, but the person who made this room happen, Grayson Challenger, fixed it. So all is good. Our topic is going to be largely my take on The Rise of Skywalker, which was thoroughly panned by our official critic, Dan Persons. I had a slightly different take on it. So did Terrence Taylor. And tonight's episode, part one of Doctor Who, beginning season 12 of the rebooted Doctor Who series. Now, Terrence is going to be with us via Skype. So what I'm going to try to get him on now, even while I am live on the air, so that, you know, this should help minimize some of the various problems. So let's see. Oh, okay. Yeah, so far it's working just fine, in fact. It'll be better when he answers. Are you there? If you are, and Terrence isn't online. Okay. Let me send him a chat message. Pardon me while I get off mic to get him to be online. Okay, and I'm going to call him yet again. We did test this just 20 minutes ago. So let's try this again. Call.
Hello?
Ah, there we are. Good, you're on the air.
Oh.
So it's all working fairly well. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Okay.
Are we actually on the air, or we're just connected?
No, we're broadcasting.
Ah, okay.
Broadcasting, webcasting, streaming, and all kinds of casts.
Huh. That's weird because I was listening to BAI on TuneIn. Maybe it was playing on earlier streams because I didn't hear your introduction or anything. This is interesting.
Did you hear the end of Paul Fisher's show or Tony Roberts? Or
I think that's what I was hearing. There was interesting music and sound samples from various Senate hearings on various topics on education and colleges.
That's WTF. K.
That's weird. So
it is very weird. It's a great show. It's one of BAI's best shows.
But it was the station, though. I was on the right station.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're here. Yeah.
And that was what was on just before you.
Yes.
So they must be running it with some sort of lag.
With a
lag going when you called me. Yes.
Almost every different way that we go out has lag. When I do a Facebook Live, Facebook Live actually seems to get to people watching it and hearing it through there faster than if they are on than if they have a radio.
Actually makes sense. Radio waves versus broadband.
Well, it's not just radio waves. I mean, we're talking about a 20-second difference or so. What it is everything that we are sending out, via IP, right? It's all internet protocol. And so, of course, one internet service can be far slower than another.
So I have no idea what you've been saying before I came on air.
Okay. Well, not much. I just said that you'd be on air and indeed here you are.
Well, at least some people in media live up to their word when they say things.
Ah, okay. So, but now that I have you on air, basically we're set up, but I still have to do announcements, which are very brief.
Okay, well, I'll sit here.
But very, very to the point, you can even chime in because you can guess that what I would be promoting for next Tuesday.
I guess I could.
It would be the first Tuesday of the month.
Oh, in that case, I can guess. Yes.
Yes. In fact, you won't guess. You know.
I do.
So the first New York Review of Science Fiction readings of the decade, I guess. I think decade really should begin next year, but it seems they start the decades with the noughts.
Yeah.
Even though the millennia, we didn't enter the third millennium until 2001.
Yeah, but people celebrated 2000 like it was the millennium. I remember the rollover from 1999 to 2000.
And that was all because of
talking 21st century at that point.
And that was all Y2K fraud.
But see, that's a whole other issue. But my feeling is that the new thing does begin at the zero number, because 2001 is the end of the first year of the new millennium. It's and so a 2001 means that a year has passed since the millennium began. So as far as I'm concerned, the 21st century began in the year 2000.
No, but it didn't.
Even as the new decade has begun in 2020.
See, millennia.
In 2021, we will have had a year of the new decade behind us.
But you see, technically, that's all wrong.
It can't be. How can it be technically wrong if. So you're saying that time has to then begin at year one, not zero, and we work our way to
that is
one.
Correct, because there was no year zero. We went from 1 BC to 1 AD.
Well, we'd have to ask people back there what they were thinking that year. But
well, they were thinking, we're a religion and we can do what we want.
Well, did what they wanted.
So yeah. Exactly. So if we count forth from that, everything begins with the aught one. But decades, they count decades from the aughts. In other words, we are now in the first, we're now in the 20s. Roaring 20s of the 21st century.
Yes.
So the first decade of our third millennium really began a year earlier, but that was really only the start of a decade. The millennium, mathematically, astronomically, scientifically, began January 1st, 2001.
Hmm.
But the decade, we are now in a new decade. It starts in 2020. We have 2020 vision now.
So you're basically saying that, like most arbitrary designations by humans, it's moot and means nothing.
Correct.
And is inconsistent and wildly contradictory.
Yes. That's exactly what I'm saying.
It's very human.
And it's very typical. But, yeah, I mean, for example, in baseball, they always do that. Since we are now in a new decade, you know, in baseball, if a person played from, let's say, 1979 through 1991, they will say that that player played in three decades. The 60, the 80s, the 90s. No, I forgot my own example. But it
79,
would,
it started in 79.
So the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. So they'll.
So they're a little. So if you even dip a toe in the pool, you swim.
They may have played for 12 years, but they will say that that person played in three decades, which, by the way, means that if I began at WBAI in 1967, as I did, I am in my seventh decade here.
Your time at WBAI is older than many people in the city.
It's older than me. I mean, if this is the seventh decade,
well, there's a friend
and I'm 60 something,
image of how is that possible? Well, because you're traveling across decades.
Because I've been in that many decades, not for that many decades.
Yes, there we go.
They do that with sports.
It's typical male sports desire to exaggerate size.
Exactly. Yeah, so. I never thought of it that way, but it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Just guys bragging.
Yeah.
I got me three decades under my belt, baby.
My calendar is larger than your calendar.
Yeah, all of it.
Yeah, exactly. So getting back to what I was going to promote.
By all means.
Next Tuesday, the 7th, at 388 Atlantic Avenue, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, we have two lovely, wonderful people, both friends of yours, Terrence.
Oh.
Hildy Silverman. You do know Hildy, right?
I believe so.
I think so. And
I'm sure if I saw her, I would. There's so many people I know by face and don't know by last name.
Okay. Well, I'll read her bio and then you'll go, oh, okay. Hildy Silverman was the editor-in-chief of Space and Time magazine for 12 years. She is, and if you saw her, I promise you, she's tall, blonde, lovely person. Her daughter's very nice. Her husband is another story. We'll talk about that off air.
Now that you've introduced it on air, I'm sure she's thrilled. Yes,
let's put it this way. It was what went on with him was a national item.
Okay.
Okay. Why are people outside this room shouting?
Hopefully they're
at
not
the top
shouting
of their
fire,
lungs.
Fire.
Well, you know what we can do in this new studio that I couldn't do before?
Shut doors?
Yeah, it's actually soundproof. So talk for a minute. I'll be right back.
Oh, that's an interesting concept. So here I am talking until Jim closes the door. How big is the room that you have to walk that far to close the door that someone has to fill time by talking? It's quite a distance, evidently. He must be going down the hall. I have this mental image of him going down the hall.
It is quite a distance. Well, you know, it's the front room, the one by the windows. And the console is all the way at one side. Then you've got to maneuver around a table that's covered with microphones.
Okay.
And, you know, not to mention taking off my headphones, turning off the mic.
All these things.
You know, all these minor things. So, yeah, it took me all of 10 seconds to actually do that stuff.
At some point when my foot is more healed and I'm more ambulatory, I'll be seeing these things again.
Yes. Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, let me finish talking about Hildy and our other guest. She is a short fiction writer whose regular recent publications include My Dear Watts, from the Baker Street Irregulars 2, The Games of Foot, The Lady of the Lakes, and sidekicked from the book Release the Virgins, edited by Michael Ventrella. Her nonfiction articles have appeared in numerous legal and medical professional journals and blogs. In the mundane world, she is the digital marketing manager for Oticon Medical U.S., which is quite cool because that means Barbara and I will occasionally get to see her at technology events. Which is cool. And our other reader is A.C. Wise.
Oh, yes.
I'm sure you know her.
Oh, yes.
Alison Campbell Wise's fiction has been published in Uncanny, Shimmer, and Tor.com. She has two collections published with Lethe Press and a novella published by Broken Eye Books. Her work has won the Sunburst Award for Excellence in Canadian Literature of the Fantastic. She lives in Philly, but okay, you can have Canadian literature, as well as being a finalist for the award twice more and a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award. She contributes the Women to Read and Non-Binary Authors to Read series to the Book Smugglers and reviews fiction and interviews other authors on her blog at acwise.net. So the two of them are going to be our featured readers, our only readers, on next Tuesday, January 7th, 2020, at 388 Atlantic Avenue. We begin at 7. Please come about 6:30 so you can partake of the new offerings at the cafe. And we will be live streaming through Facebook. And eventually we're going to collect this stuff and get it over to YouTube. But right now, our live stream goes to Facebook. And it's either going to be on the Brooklyn Commons page, but we're going to try to switch it this month, that it will be on my page, Jim Freund, on Facebook. And the reason for that is that that way I have the control to share it to different groups. I'll be able to share it to the New York Review of Science Fiction group, to the WBAI radio group, to the Hour of the Wolf group, for that matter, as well as the Brooklyn Commons Cafe group. So we're trying that this coming month. So again, at it's this Tuesday, 7 o'clock, 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free. Donations begged for. And that covers it. I'll mention it again later. So, under normal circumstances, Terrence, even though I have caved in before to allowing you to sit in your hammock, are you in your hammock?
I'm actually on the couch with my foot up on several pillows to elevate it above my heart.
Okay. There. Oh, Jesus.
Yes, that's my life when I'm not at the computer, because I get at the computer and swell my foot, then the rest of the night is unswelling my foot.
Yeah, so Terrence, who originally set up the live streaming and stuff, made it. He didn't put in the equipment, but he made it technologically possible, and engineered the first things out of that studio or cafe, I should say, that have ever come out of there. Normally, I would make you come up to the station. You know, I'd pick you up en route and drop you off. But at this hour, we don't have an elevator.
Oh, that would not have worked for me today.
So even if you were, even if you called me and said, "Hey, Jim, can I do your show?" I'll say, "Yeah, can you climb?
Can you crawl up three
Can you crawl up three flights of stairs?"
Now, why is it that there's no certain hours they turn off the elevator? I don't remember that.
Yeah, it's only when the cafe it's only when the cafe is open.
But in the past, I thought we had used the elevator at some point.
It may have somehow accidentally happened, and we wouldn't mention that to anybody.
Ah, that must have been my imagination.
Yes, and also since that happened, there were people crawling around on floors, you know, getting into the cafe at night, because you see, that's the thing. It's people could come from any floor, including the floor we are on at 388, and could just descend into the cafe and, maybe cook up a meal or something like that. And
how
Or just take a few bottles of vino or whatever it may be. So
that got fixed.
Just as the control room downstairs is now locked, there are only four keys. I have one.
Okay.
This is something that you've been complaining about since day one, that it wasn't locked and anybody could go in there.
Everything was an open yes.
Yeah, and this is, so there's now a greater...
Settings were changed. You had no idea what had happened when you left. Yes,
so there's a greater sense of security for the building. And also, while all this is happening, BAI is losing about half of the space that we have on the third floor to somebody who actually pays their rent.
Well, that would sort of make somebody reconsider things, wouldn't it? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the deal is, let me explain to listeners, our landlady is an extremely supportive to WBAI person and very forgiving. But the fact of the matter is, given the debacle that occurred in October and threats from former members of the WBAI national board, the main one of which was his contract was not renewed. He is no longer with us. Pardon this tear. And he said, well, we're never paying you again, blah, 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 which, you know, was a lie. But we have been behind in the rent. And the deal is that one of the tenants on the second floor needed to expand. And if they couldn't get more space in this building,
they were going to another building.
Exactly. And these were people who pay on time.
Yes. These are the kind of people we like in a building that we own when we pay taxes on that building.
Yeah. Well, and taxes is what it's all about.
No
matter how forgiving the owner may be, she has to pay realty taxes.
And they are significant in Brooklyn these days.
They are.
Especially. The residential can only grow so far, but the commercial taxes on Fifth Avenue, when I found out how much tax my downstairs neighbor was paying on her building on Fifth Avenue and 7th, it was like, whoa, oh my God.
Yeah, so
she was barely making enough to cover expenses.
So you can imagine that. 5 blocks in the Barclay Center.
Oh, yeah. Oh, please. Yes, I can only imagine.
Yeah, so while
if you own it, the taxes are still there. Yeah.
This is a very unhappy situation, but it's also thoroughly understandable.
Oh, yeah.
That is...
And you don't need but so much room to make the station anyway. You need a mic and a booth, damn it.
Yeah, well, now we've got...
God knows you've done it with less.
We have. I mean, we're basically going down to the size, I would say, of what WBAI was like in the 1967 when we were in a brownstone building on East 39th Street in Manhattan. So I would say that the revised WBAI is about the same size. So what we're losing are offices.
Yes, yes.
We will have one other studio, one booth, and our broadcast room.
But it seemed like most of the people with shows did their work and material preparation offsite anyway, so... Offices aren't essential to the operation of the station at this point.
Well, I think the station manager and program director would say otherwise, but we'll see what plans they have. They also don't need to be on site.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, they can work out of office space elsewhere.
Yeah.
I don't think I think she wants to be very much on site, but the station manager not as much. But at any rate, I shouldn't be double guessing them.
Not when you're not done finishing the announcements.
I did.
Oh, that was the last of them?
That was it. I finished the announcements. It's basically everybody within the sound of the broadcast of my voice, either A, come here next Tuesday at 7 o'clock, 388 Atlantic Avenue, or tune in on Facebook Live. That's it. In a nutshell, Hildy Silverman and Allison Campbell Wise, two wonderful, fun, and sometimes very serious writers of speculative fiction.
There we go.
There we go. And so yeah, that's basically the announcements. And what I now I have had traditions on this show for years and years and years. One of them was the Tolkien broadcast at the end of the year, somewhere, you know, as a December celebration. And then at the beginning of the year, I would usually do a Steel Eye Span mix of music, you know, Irish Celtic stuff. But with the new equipment, my unfamiliarity with a new console and things like that, I thought that was not a great idea. And because we are on the cusp of ending one major series, and on and having just ended also The Mandalorian, and we are on the beginning of season 12 of Doctor Who, I thought it would be a good idea to discuss that with you on the air, and we can take listener calls.
And warn everyone, there will probably be massive spoilers because we'll want to
discuss
it.
Thank you. So. This is going to be the opposite of a spoiler-free discussion. This is going to be...
We're say this every few minutes.
We're a bunch of spoiled folk here. And so, in other words, in order to properly discuss the whole Skywalker saga, which is, they call it 9 films, I consider it 11 films. And despite the end of the Skywalker saga, we will have to discuss things that were brought up in episode 7, like who Rey's parents are. And more to the point, who her family is. And I don't think outside of that, there are any major surprises.
Well, you know, who lives, who dies sort of things.
Well, who lives or dies, but that's all actually fairly predictable. You know, I think I think you can tell from episode 7 who's going to be standing in episode 9.
Yeah, they could have thrown a few spins on that ball, though.
Yeah, a few. But they did it in a very, I would say, predictable manner and a very comfortable manner. And there are some people who hated it. Many people hated the last film, the one directed by Rian Johnson, called The Last Jedi. I enjoyed it a lot, I have to say. And, well, I've got my opinion on that. I will say that our official movie critic, Dan Persons, and I played his review 2 weeks ago, loathed this movie. And we'll play that review again at some point.
Look, it's better than a Lawrence Kasdan Star Wars movie. So I mean, anything you start at that level gets better. I was never a big fan of his scripts.
Remember that he finished the script for Lee Brackett on The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, well,
and that's one of their better scripts. But it was Lee Brackett's script. She had the misfortune to die in her mid-80s.
Kasdan still got his hands on it. What can I say?
Yeah, I do take more issues in the original trilogy. His solo script is Return of the Jedi, and I think it's fairly weak. I don't disagree with you. I'm just pointing out that he does have credit, and he takes credit in interviews for The Empire Strikes Back.
Well, I'm sure, you know, and he's entitled to do that. And it explains a lot. As far as I'm concerned, the 9 films form the core of Lucas's original vision for what he was doing, and sort of wraps up that. Obviously, we're going to have Star Wars movies coming out of the studio.
And TV shows.
Long after our deaths, they will be churning out Star Wars movies. And, you know, someone was conjecturing, and they're going, well, maybe it'll be prequels. It could be anything. I mean, prequels, you can just continue the story from the point that the 9th one ends.
Well, just
I think the others fit into it, but I don't see them as part of the basic core story of the serial adventure that began with the first movie.
They are not. And they have a tendency to not put too much in there. But even with the first trilogy, episodes 1, 2, and 3, in pulling from races and characters like the Sith, they were pulling into a larger universe than the movies had, and then you've got to deal with, I don't remember or know or even care at a certain point, just how many cartoon animated shows there are.
Well, yeah, I mean, the 3D and 2D, but I mean, that's why I say that.
There's the Clone Wars, the Star Wars, Rebels. I have the pinball games.
Well, I'm sure there are popsicle sticks. But I think for the purposes of this conversation, I want to limit it to the 9 films
the 11
self-contained
films.
Unit, the 9 films. I don't count the others in that. I'm still, like I say, what I'm going with purist.
Okay.
I'm going with the original concept of not 3 trilogies set in 3 different time periods.
Which was Lee Brackett's outline when she joined Lucas.
But that was the beginning concept of the thing.
Right.
So regardless of whether other movies fit in, those other movies that you're fitting into make it 11, I don't believe start with an episode number and a long crawl explaining where we are in the story.
Well, they wouldn't do that, but I would make an argument with the movie Rogue One.
But I'm still saying no. For the purpose of this conversation, we are referring to the Star Wars triple
play trilogy. It's actually what we would call the Skywalker saga.
There we go. So.
And there's no Skywalker at all in Solo. So, yes, right. We can safely.
But Solo's a prequel. I mean, these are all spin-offs and background material.
Okay.
And they contribute to the mythology.
But Rogue One is not a prequel.
The Skywalker saga is a one big chunk for me.
Rogue One takes place after episodes 1, 2, and 3. I call it episode 3.9.
Except it's not, because that's not how you do movie serial adventures. I'm a real stickler on this. I will fight you with a death on this. It's like, no, there are 9 of these movies. They are a self-contained unit. Everything else is additional to the genre of this particular franchise. But there are 9 movies as envisioned. They tell a singular story that I think overall works. I think there are very strong parts, very weak parts. I actually enjoyed the last one. I mean, bottom line, trilogies are always difficult, which is why I've taken over 10 years to write my third novel of the series.
Yeah, now we haven't introduced you properly. We should say that you have 2 books out of a trilogy.
Bite Marks. Working on the third for the last 2 years and full. Bite Marks and Blood Pressure.
Which really
should have been called Blood Pressures. It should have been plural.
Yeah.
That's why you long for enough sales for reprints. But part of the issue always with trilogies is that doing a third story that isn't just, oh yeah, I knew that from the first two, because there are certain things that get set up in the first two that end up being paid off. One of the things I love about Nora's novels, N.K. Jemisin, is that she would do trilogies. The third one, I'm actually in the second novel of the last trilogy. So it applies differently because that's more of a continuity. But in the last trilogy, each book was about a different character, different time period. There were effects from the previous novels, but you weren't following the same story over across 3 books. You were following 3 different stories set in that universe around that time period with different motifs. And that really is a smarter way of doing it, I realized, after the fact. But the thing is, with the first, the 4, 5, and 6, by the time we got to 6, there were very few surprises in 6. Because they'd set up so much stuff in 4 and 5 that we knew what they were going to. We knew Luke and Leia were going to be brother and sister. Darth Vader is his father and all these different things.
So 6.
Spoilers if you haven't seen it after that.
Yeah.
And 1, 2, and 3 the same way. I mean, the third one was at least a little more grown up than the first two, which my secret theory was that we'll make the first two suck big time so that as you watch the 9 movies, they just keep getting better. And it's like, you know, so we can't make a really great first movie and second movie because they'll start to suck by the fourth movie if they've gotten too great expectations. So the first 3 are like, okay, yeah.
No, I actually like episode 3.
Three got it off to a rolling start.
Yeah, what I would say is
because it stopped being a kid's movie.
In an ideal universe, they take episodes 1 and 2, and cut them down to a total between the two movies of 20 minutes. And then put it on, tack that on to the beginning of Revenge of the Sith, episode 3. So you only need the one movie then. And that would be a pretty good film.
But it wouldn't be a 9-picture saga.
Well, then they should have written
what was originally intended. Look, they should have written them better. I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that, but that's why Lucas isn't running the franchise anymore.
Exactly.
You know, the problem though is that because Disney is running the franchise, originality. I mean, what am I trying to say?
Well, the same producers
Disney
are running.
Disney does
it,
a lot of things really well, but you know, there isn't a lot of risk taking. So, yeah, I mean, I think the main criticism that people have with the last movie is that there's very little risk taking. There is almost nothing that's not expected. I mean, you just see it all play out. But that's what the third of each of the series was just seeing what you expected to have happen play out. And that's good or bad, depending on how much you wanted to see that just happen in front of you.
But in trilogies 2 and 3, as opposed to using words like the original trilogy and all that. Mm-hmm. And by the way, people should know that when I refer to what they call episode 4, A New Hope, I just call it Star Wars, because I saw that movie, God help me, you know, I am not a person who says, oh, I see this 100 times and all that, and, you know, I didn't eat for 9 months while I watched that movie. I did see Star Wars on big screens, mostly the Los Astor Plaza, about 25 times.
Yeah.
They were running it 24 hours a day.
Oh, I'm sure. I don't remember where I saw it. I would imagine I saw it at the Ziegfeld, because that was the sort of standard for big, wonderful.
There would be one problem. There would be one little time. There would be one little problem with that.
Yeah,
it never ran at the Ziegfeld.
Okay, it wouldn't have been there then. So I'm not sure where I saw it.
It was at the main it was at the Los Astor Plaza, the Los Orpheum.
In Times Square, the one in Times Square?
So
I saw Blade Runner.
No. Hmm. It didn't play near Times Square at all, ever.
Well, it's moot.
Or if it did, beyond its original. The point, a little history for people out there. Star Wars opened in 1977, okay? And Empire is, 1980, or is it 81? It's one of those two. It was within a month of Mount St. Helens exploding. So people can look it up and figure it out from that. Or people can say, all right, do it the other way. Mount St. Helens exploded when Empire Strikes Back came out. At any rate, it was
so exciting.
It was re-edited for the first time ever, spiffing up some of the special effects. And that's when they tacked on episode 4. And they added things, minor things, to the film. This is before the big re-digitization. Which is pretty poor. It just clutters the screen up. One of the things that I really like about the Rise of Skywalker and The Mandalorian is that the planets, especially the desert planets, look relatively bare.
Bleak, yes.
You know, they're not as busy as when Lucas, refurbished those films are. So it was a retro rethink. And the idea of creating, changing Star Wars into A New Hope, that's a Lee Brackett premise. And she had a premise that went further to Revenge of the Jedi. That would be the third film. And that was going to take place on the Wookiee planet. And the and which, by the way, would be a very technologically advanced.
Well, that would at least distinguish it from the little wombats.
They were talking about slide walks.
Oh God!
You know, and
that seems so weirdly not Wookiee, but what the hell? Why not?
But it was what she was thinking, and the marketers. Lucas now has a tiger by the tail. You know, he and Lucasfilms, he now has an empire. of his own, including Industrial Light and Magic and the video game division and things like that. And the marketers said, this is the way the story is generally told, you know, we really can't sell Wookiees. So why don't you make them short and cute? And instead of Wookiee, Ewok. And that's how the Ewoks were bred.
This is why the NBA should not run the artistic element of things.
Exactly. And the third. Oh, and they're the ones who changed it from Revenge of the Jedi
to Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, because
it's so hard.
Jedis are good guys. They wouldn't want
so
revenge.
Mean.
You can have Revenge of the Sith. But you can't have Revenge of the Good Guys.
Oh, screw that crap.
Yeah, exactly. So that's...
So they go low, we go high. No, we should go low and just kick them right where they need it.
So that's why episode 7, but the third film, is, I think, the weakest of the original trilogy. And then there are people who say that Empire Strikes Back is the best film of the 9 films.
Mm-hmm.
And cinematically speaking, they're probably right. But I will distinguish best and favorite. That's fair.
Well, see, I think that's true. And truthfully, you know, I mean, the thing is, these movies have been released over decades.
42 years ago.
And I cannot remember all of the details of each and every one of them to even be able to, like, really, truly, honestly say which one I enjoyed more than the other. I remember flashes. I remember moments like Luke in the cave training with Yoda. I remember, you know, certain scenes of emotion or fights. But, yeah, I mean, I would have to spend, God, I hate to even think of how much time watching them all back-to-back to really decide what I felt about the whole thing.
Well, for people who have Disney Plus, you can do exactly that.
A weekend doing that. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, so like maybe in my retirement when I'm not done doing things, I'll just sit for like the 18 hours it takes to sit through all of those uncut, you know, and I'll finally. But but what I like about the concept is that it does what series do, the new concept of streaming series where you have storylines over seasons as opposed to over episodes, is that, you know, video programming becoming more novelistic. You know, when you're dealing with 9 films telling 90 to 2.5 hours
of story. Now they consider a lot of what they're doing a 9-hour film.
Yeah, but it's you know, it's comparable watching that, or the Lord of the Rings trilogy is comparable to reading War or Peace or any 2,000-page Stephen King novel. I mean, it's a different level of storytelling that takes place over time.
And yet, curiously,
as much as it takes place over events.
The way you are talking, I think it's clear you have not seen The Mandalorian.
No, I don't have Disney Plus.
Okay. Well, The Mandalorian is actually episodic. You could it's better if you watch at episode 1 because of the big reveal, which everybody in the world knows.
This is what, Baby Yoda?
Actually called...
Except it's not Yoda.
Exactly. He's called The Child. Mm-hmm. The only reference to him in the series and the only reference to him in credits are simply The Child.
Well, it's not like Yoda was the only one of his race, and that it seems likely there would be others and that they would be equally spiritual because that was their culture. So
it's a big, big galaxy that's far, far away.
One would like to think.
And, you know, there are also so many books in that universe we haven't even mentioned, you know, aside from the TV series, the animated things. I don't know how many Star Wars books there are. There must be 30 or 40.
Well, you know, when the machine starts grinding, it produces much. It's supply and demand. I mean, if people keep wanting stories set in that universe, they're going to keep supplying them. They'll be uneven. Some will be really great, and some will be mediocre. Some will find their way to series. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. But my point was that The Mandalorian is unusual, and one of the things that was so much fun about it is, A, they didn't drop them, as is the current phrase, all at once. One episode every Friday.
Yeah, well, I like that. I mean, Doom Patrol was doing that on DC universe.
Exactly.
I mean, I could go through and list a couple of series. And truthfully, I kind of like that because if you want to binge it, you can wait till the end and watch it all at once. But I sat there and binged through Umbrella Academy in 2 days, and I've got over a year to wait for season two. And
yeah,
there's a part of me I wish I hadn't gobbled it down quite so quickly and just sort of like eaten it a little slower and savored it a bit more. So.
Yeah, whereas it took The Mandalorian 2 months to play out.
Yeah,
and there was only one cliffhanger at all. You know, episode 7, the end of episode 7 leads into the beginning of episode 8, and the problem that is set up at the end of 7 is resolved within 5 minutes of episode 8. So it's really just a cliffhanger.
Well, it's very Whovian. I mean, it's sort of...
It is very Whovian.
You know, I mean, it's like... But also, it's...
But otherwise, it was individual episodes. You should, if you accept the concept of, even though it's wrong, we'll call him Baby Yoda, yeah, assuming it's a
the
him.
Child.
Yeah, we don't
is
know.
Is he a regular in the series? Is he consistently in it? Is that why they're making such a big deal of him?
Let's put it this way. You could get rid of the Mandalorian. You could not get rid of the child.
Oh, well, that's good to know.
It's all about the child. It's he is wanted by many, many major forces in the galaxy. He is the most powerful character with the Force that
so
has
he's,
been.
He's the golden child, and
yes,
Eddie Murphy will be guest appearing.
Exactly,
as he goes pursuing the golden child.
He is very much like that character, and it's even there's even a plot similarity between that and Golden Child, given...
Why, you'd almost think it's because there's no originality in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So and that it continues to feed off its old stories over and over again.
Yeah, there was a secret, because the Mandalorian never takes off his mask, and we don't really know, is he a good guy or not? We know it takes place 5 years after the end of the first trilogy. I should say the second trilogy, the original.
Really? Yes, let's call it what it is.
After episode 6... takes place 5 years later. The Empire is gone, but their Imperial forces are hiring themselves out as mercenaries. And you have Mandalorians all over the place. Now, what we did not know, if we're only watching the movies, which is all I watched, is that Boba Fett was a Mandalorian.
I kind of figured from the design of the helmet that there was a connection of some kind or other.
And there were even rumors that the Mandalorian, who for 7 out of the 8 episodes didn't even have a name, they call him Mando.
So is Mandalorian a designation like Centurion or Samurai?
Yes.
He's a mercenary.
It's a class.
That's what they call them. Yeah.
It's a class. The actual word that they use in the series, they say, no, it's not a race. It's not people from one planet.
Right.
It's a class.
So people can join the Mandalorians and
that's
be
correct.
Trained to become one.
Yeah. And you can have women Mandalorian and men Mandalorian. But
they just must never take off their masks.
But that's right. They must never be seen. That's a big part. We do see Mando's face, and we learn his name in episode 8, and it's, guess what? He's just a Mandalorian. He's not Boba Fett. We don't...
Well, I wouldn't think so.
You know,
wasn't Boba Fett what they cloned all the clone soldiers from? Wasn't that revealed in one of the movies that basically all the guys in the white uniforms up until the latest movies when they're kidnapping children and enlisting them into the army, but then all the clones were clones of Boba Fett?
No. I don't believe so. No,
Boba
they're
Fett's
not related.
Son?
They're not related. You join. You join the Marines.
No. The Clone Wars, the white uniformed soldiers in one of the movies, it was established that they were just being rolled out from a factory from a planet. It was in one of the...
Well, the second movie is called Clone Wars, right? Episode 2.
Yes,
is called Clone Wars.
The Clone Wars came from, like, movie episode 2 or 3. And
but we only ever see one Mandalorian in all the 9 films, and that's Boba Fett.
Yes, but what I'm okay. I have to go Google this. And
okay,
I just seem to remember that Boba Fett was the source of the clones because at some point he took his helmet, or his son was. I could be misremembering this completely.
I don't know about that. It doesn't sound right to me. But the point is that Mando is not Boba Fett. That is
no, yes, exactly.
That's the only thing I'm trying to say here. Yeah. Okay, that's it. I don't need to go further than that.
Here we go.
Okay.
Star Wars Episode 2, gotta love the internet. Attack of the Clones revealed that Boba Fett is a clone of the bounty hunter Jango Fett, who raises him as his son.
Jango? Really? Jango?
Yes. So Jango, J-A-N-G-O.
Not D-J-A-N-G-O. No, no. Oh, too bad.
But yes, no, because I remembered this. It was like, no, there was a connection between Boba Fett and the clones. Boba Fett is identical to all the clone soldiers in the white uniforms. He was just raised by the source of the clone.
Okay.
Which was Jango Fett.
Okay, but he's still his own creature.
He's still his own guy because he didn't go off to join the army.
And he does actually die at the end of Episode 6.
Yes.
He gets eaten by that worm.
Well, this is very funny. So you know how they always have little questions like underneath every search thing? Why did Jango Fett want a clone? And it's like not because he wanted an actual replica of himself, but he wanted to have a son by cloning. When the Republic approached him to get his DNA to make a clone army, he said, sure, but if you're cloning me, you got to give me one to raise as my son, evidently.
I'm going to have to look at Episode 2 again, if I can bear it. It's not Episode 2 that's the unbearable one. It's Episode 1 that's unbearable because of Jar Jar. Two things. It's
Jar Jar Binks and that cute little kid who's just, you just want to...
Yeah, those are the two points. This white bread, spoiled little. Can you believe that blonde boy has been a slave?
Well, but that's the thing. I was thinking that earlier. Is that was the biggest problem with the casting of that? Was that this is not like a kid who lived a hard, rough life in the frontier. He looked like, you know, he just stepped in from the casting office. It was like 80s cuteness, the bowler haircut, the Beatles haircut.
Exactly.
He just wanted to, like, you know, push his face into the mud and say, kid, get some work done. Learn how to survive in the wilderness.
I still do want to push his face into the mud.
And it's terrible. It's a child. We shouldn't speak so of him. It's the curse of being an actor is that people will say horrible things about you. It's about the portrayal of him in the character as the character. I don't want this poor person thinking we dislike him. Well, I'm sure he's a talented actor, but...
Jake Lloyd may be a perfectly talented actor. I don't know what he's doing today. But I can tell you that the director and writer were George Lucas. And that's also... And remember, Lucas has a racing car fetish, which explains a lot of the plot of that movie.
Well, yes, the ships, they fly, yes, all the races.
Yeah, but it's a racing planet. That's why people go there.
Yes,
just like Tatooine is a spice planet.
Yes,
people mine spice and smuggle it and stuff. It's basically taken out of Dune.
Well, I was going to say, I thought it was very funny when they were talking about the guy being a spice smuggler in the last movie. Because it was like spice. Where did he get that? On Dune? What the heck is that coming over from?
Well,
but I'd forgotten that Tatooine had spices on it.
You may recall that we know from the start that Luke's aunt and uncle, they're spice farmers. They're spice farmers. And we see the skeleton of a worm in the background.
Yeah. So basically, they were living in another franchise. That's why they had to die.
I mean, there is very, very little in Star Wars
that hasn't been in something else.
that wasn't synthesized by Lucas from the things that he loved the most.
Including Princess Leia's little silver bikini outfit, I imagine.
Well, that's not... Okay, when I say Star Wars, I'm talking about a movie called Star Wars.
Okay.
I'm not talking about the Skywalker saga. I'm talking about what... other people call Episode 4 A New Hope.
I'm just saying he continued that throughout the others. He pushed in a lot of things he liked.
Yes, but
one of them was a silver bikini for Leia.
Copper. But
copper, silver. It's still revealing.
I enjoyed that outfit. It was even safe bondage.
Yes,
because Jabba is always holding a chain.
Yes.
And it was Carrie Fisher at her most fetching.
Piquant.
Oh, there's a good word. Yes, absolutely. But no, it's within 10 minutes of episode 4, A New Hope, otherwise known as Star Wars, that it is established that they are spice farmers. They say it.
Yeah.
Only once.
That's all it takes.
But that's all it takes. And the main Robbie Barish, who I only recently found out, he was one of the great announcers at WBAI. Robbie informed me at one point. He said, "Have you? Oh, now the name has just gone out of my head. The Star Kings by Edmond Hamilton." And I said, no, I can't say I've read it. And he said, but you've seen the movie. It's like, excuse me? And if you read The Star Kings by Edmond Hamilton, you will see, I would say, about, 20-25% of the plot points that are in episode 4. That's one of the main primary sources, not to mention every Republic serial.
Well, also, I still keep citing the play Warp, which is a three-part science fiction adventure play about a young man from the country who teams up with a warrior princess, a mage, and a hairy animal-like companion to fight the evil empire, all dressed in identical outfits. It ran on Broadway. The first play ran and then shut down. They didn't last very long, unfortunately. So I never got to see the second two.
No, the second two never opened on Broadway. They played in Chicago.
That's what I'm saying.
They played in Chicago.
They closed after the first one, and they never ran the second two.
The second two played.
Which is why I never got to see
them. The second two played in Chicago, where the show came from originally.
I thought it was San Francisco, because I thought I'd read that it was in San Francisco a couple of years before. There was a
I thought it was the other way around. I thought it went from Chicago to San Francisco.
Yes, but it seemed to be in San Francisco several years before Star Wars was.
And it was a wonderful show.
Devised that I still have my poster, which is now signed by Neil Adams. Thank you, Comic-Con.
Yes. And
I have to get that
and most of the, and signed. Most of them got it through WBAI because Neil Adams gave me 50 posters.
50 for more signed?
Yes.
You didn't tell me that.
Yeah, I've told you that. I know I've told you that. It's what brought Robert Knight, the late Robert Knight, whose time slot, Earthwatch, we are still in. It's 2 o'clock, by the way, in New York, and this is WBAI New York. And Robert was on from midnight to 3 for some years, and later on, it moved around. But suffice it to say that why did I bring up Robert? What was I talking about?
Warp.
Warp, yes, absolutely. Robert first came to WBAI to collect. He first came to WBAI to collect a Warp poster from me. And Neil came to the radio station. Frank Heller, who was a regular producer at BAI, who I knew since about I was 4 years old from Jackson Heights. He lived in my uncle's building. Frank Heller was one of the very few people who will know what this means, I think. He was a crusty bunker.
No, I do not know what that means.
Okay, a crusty bunker is an intern for Neil Adams. Neil, in other words, he would do the drawings and the sketches and everything, and then some people would, the pencil's probably done by Marie Severin, who died this past year.
Yeah.
And when they were done with it, the crusty bunkers did a lot of the work. And they were in the bullpen at Marvel. And it was through Frank, who doubled at WBAI and as a crusty bunker, that I met Neil Adams, and we got these wonderful posters and premiums. It could be that they gave some to Comic-Con, which was a very small thing in those days. But we had 5-0.
I just remember it being a lowly show, great fun, and we got there. I think we may have seen it twice because we were there the last show.
Yeah, well, it only ran for like, what, 2 weeks?
Yeah, it didn't run very long, and but you know, Broadway was very cheap in those days. I mean, I saw Two Gentlemen of Verona orchestra seats for $12, so we went to see Sleuth twice. I could easily have seen Work twice in the 2 weeks it was open.
Yeah,
especially since they weren't selling tickets, because that's why they were closing the last time we saw it. The second time we saw it, they were like shutting down.
The producers were worried about recouping the expense, is what it was. The show would have made money.
A good time in a smaller venue, maybe? I don't know. But it was great fun. I made a wonderful costume. Okay, one of the things that I loved about this show was the mage character makes his entrance floating on a table.
I was going to say, if I was to talk about it, I would say exactly what you're saying.
Yes. Now, the thing you have to understand, though, is so he comes out, and it was a beautiful example of stage illusion, because essentially it was a guy standing up with a table around his waist, fake legs on top of folded on top of the table.
Yeah, he's sitting in lotus position.
Yes, and then the tablecloth conceals the actor's actual legs, and if you walk properly, it looks like you're just gliding around the stage. So a couple of years later, I made that as a costume for Halloween. I got a bunch of foam core.
Perfect.
I made a, like, you know, 3-foot round table to fit around my waist, had suspender things to hold it up, put a tablecloth on it that covered it down to the ground and dragged a little bit to obscure my feet, and put in inflated legs and a robe and did the whole thing, and it works great. I mean, it was just fabulous.
You saw that show and you say, how in God's name were they able to make that happen?
I knew immediately, because I'm a clever little dinkum. But the thing is that what I loved about it is how simple it was to do and how well it worked. And it did.
And also very, very good use of Neil Adams drawings and Day-Glow paint.
No, well, lots of things like that, yes. But yeah, it was a great fun thing. But I always think of that, because when Star Wars came out, I was like, well, wait a minute. This is like that play. Isn't this, are you sure he never saw this? It's like, so
yeah,
whatever.
No, he didn't see it by the time he was writing it. But let's also face the fact that this is a major template. Now let's go back to The Star Kings by Edmund Hamilton.
Well, yeah, that was drawing in the same source.
Which is from the 1950s. And I knew Edmund Hamilton's name very well, because he was married to one of my favorite science fiction writers, who was also extremely experienced in writing screenplays. Do I have to finish the story? Can you figure it out?
Well, you can go on, but I probably...
Okay. Among the screenplays she wrote were for Howard Hawks, The Big Sleep.
Oh.
She wrote along with... what's his name? That's Southerner, but the and Jules Firthman. But what's the name of the Southerner? The great, great writer.
Tennessee Williams.
No, he didn't write movies. It'll come to me. Some caller will text me, you know, something like that. At any rate, she wrote The Big Sleep. She wrote The War Wagon for John Ford. She wrote mostly westerns. She wrote mostly genre for the movies. She wrote some noir. And then she ultimately wrote something called The Empire Strikes Back. Her name is Lee Brackett.
I didn't know she wrote The Big Sleep. The Big Sleep is one of my favorite noir movies.
Oh, she also wrote She wrote The Long Goodbye. She wrote two Marlowe films.
Oh, yeah. But now, The Long Goodbye done by Altman, or The Long
Robert
Goodbye?
Robert Altman.
Altman's Long Goodbye. Yeah, that was a good one.
Starring Elliot Gould.
But there was like this for years people would talk about how inexplicable The Big Sleep was, and I'd seen it many times, and it always made sense to me.
It's always made sense to me, too.
I know
who killed the chauffeur.
I mean, it all makes sense if you pay attention. I think people just don't listen enough sometimes to what people are saying in movies.
That's because...
But great, great movie. And the major influence on Chinatown, to me. I mean, Chinatown was closest to that of all of them.
Yes, absolutely. And to an extent also, Motherless Brooklyn.
You know, I haven't seen that yet. I'm curious. I have a screener.
I've seen it twice. I saw it first at the venue they were screening it at, Warner Brothers in, what's that new little town we have on the west side? with all the huge office.
Hudson Yards?
That's it.
They've already got a screening room at Hudson Yards. Good
Are
God.
You kidding?
They've got this giant
all of HBO, AT&T, Warner
like
Brothers, all the entire megalithic company is
with
there.
With their massive millions of dollars of tax breaks that Bloomberg gave them.
Yes.
You know, which all just got breezed right through without anyone noticing, or we would have been having some complaints like there were about Amazon moving in and getting tax breaks. I still don't understand the concept that Amazon doesn't pay any tax. It's like, how are they doing that, and why are they doing that? Why are we not taxing Amazon and paying off the deficit? Because the product and the amount of tax, they'd still be making billions of dollars, and we wouldn't have a deficit. It would be lovely.
Apparently, Google is now giving up their offshore tax breaks.
Well, they should all be doing it because, they should not be getting the benefits of being an American company if they are not being an American company.
Well,
if their assets are offshore,
I totally
if their manufacturing
agree.
Is offshore, if they're bringing the stuff in from China to sell in America and calling it an American company, and America goes down and they're still fine, they are not an American company. They need to be onshore. They need to do American manufacturing, damn it, and they need to pay their goddamn taxes. That's
and they need to hire more Americans, yes.
I keep saying I want to see like the cities that got abandoned by the automotive industry embraced by the hardware companies for computers. Detroit turned into manufacturing for Apple.
Flint.
All of those towns.
Yes.
I mean, you've got workforce.
Mostly Michigan, yeah.
Yeah, but they could be trained to assemble computers as well as anything else.
And there are also towns.
And you could revolutionize these cities.
There are also towns that where IBM used to be.
Yeah.
So they already were tech and use nice big companies to move there.
But at any rate,
the screener for Motherless Brooklyn was in the Hudson Yards in the most beautiful screening room I have ever been in.
Still had new screening room smell.
It did. Oh my God, it did.
Not open long enough for dust to be building up in the AC system yet.
They didn't even have much artwork on the walls yet.
And, minimalism.
It hasn't all been inhabited yet. They haven't moved all of their divisions in, and the building is big enough for companies, as well as the megalith that is the Warner Brothers, DC Comics, AT&T, and all that. All now in this one monster of a building, but that's
great. Let's build a bigger target for Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not the only big building in Hudson Yards, by the way.
No, I can see it from 13. They were building it in my view. The thing that I didn't realize for a long time, because I never could quite figure
out. We have to explain to people you don't mean 13th Street, but that you
Channel
work 13. At Channel 13.
I do producing for on-air fundraising for Channel 13. This has been multiply discussed on the show, and
Yes, but there are people who've never heard this show before that are listening right now.
Yes, I know, and that's why we're filling them in.
So
the thing is that we're on the 12th floor of the building on 50th between 8th and 9th, but we have a view facing south from the area that I work in, which reveals the rise of Hudson Yards. Now, the thing you have to understand is that we are in the building at 50th and 8th Avenue, because we were in a building on 33rd Street between 8th and 9th. And the space that we had, it was a whole complex thing. The people, I can't remember the family's name, but the family owned a building on 23rd Street where they donated space to GMHC, the Gay Men's Health Crisis. They were selling that building and developing, so they gave the Gay Men's Health Crisis the space that Channel 13 was in, which was two floors on that building. And then they moved 13, which had a studio and a master control room and was perfectly set up for broadcasting television. But we moved out of there. We moved to 50th and 8th Avenue. We've made do quite well. We've got a studio now in 60th and Broadway. Master control is all out of Poughkeepsie now anyway, because that's how things are done these days, et cetera. But the thing is that out of the office window, I was watching the block that the old office had been on transform into Hudson Yards. And I hadn't realized it till I went to Comic-Con last year and came out of the subway at that new number seven train station that's built in the base of Hudson Yards. But yeah, that area, the change in it in the last not even 10 years, it's been less than 10 years.
It's basically,
astonishing.
It now has a major subway stop on the 7 train.
Yeah.
And it's a new little city over there.
Now, there's some weird giant terrace on the Avengers building, because there's a building that looks just like the Avengers building. And they've got this weird giant terrace on it. And because of the way nature of these things, they have to do public space on all of these things. So I have to go find out if there's an amazing deck with a wonderful vista to go see from there that I can go eat lunch on from time to time. But, yeah, it's just astounding.
At any rate, that's where Motherless Brooklyn was playing. And I know that you have a link to a screener because you're a member of Writers Guild of America East.
Yes,
proudly. And now my partner, Barbara Krasnoff, is as well. So for the first year for us, you're getting
stacks of screeners pouring through your mailbox that you have to
watch. Oh, my God. We have about 40 DVDs.
I know. And electronic screeners.
And a bunch.
That's going to be the future.
The other thing is, and this is something I still have to look into, if a movie is that is up for a Writers Guild Award is playing in one of the selected theaters that they have ready.
You can present your card and just go in with a guest. Yes.
That's right.
Yes, this is true. I always forget that. I should look at the ads and see which ones have that little logo on them.
Yeah exactly. So I've seen Motherless Brooklyn twice. It got middling reviews. I think it's one of the candidates for Best Film of the Year. Possibly Best Director, possibly Best Adapted Screenplay. Which is, and all of those awards go to one person, Edward Norton.
Yeah.
And he is brilliant. Help me now with the pronunciation.
Did you see Ed Norton on the Comedy Central roast of what I think it was Bruce Willis?
No.
He was hilarious. Google it. You got to go to YouTube and see what he said.
I will do that. But let me ask you this: with all the screeners you have.
Yeah.
What of what you have seen and what you know of what's out there, what do you consider the best movie of 2019?
Oh, please. I haven't even gotten 10% of the way through these things.
Okay.
I mean, I've seen Parasite, which was like, whoa.
I haven't watched it. Let me ask you. You know my aversion to certain violent things. I don't mean violent. I mean gory.
Yeah, let's say the blood is subdued, but the violence is at times high level.
Okay, I don't have a problem with that.
There's no organs dripping. It's psychologically shocking what happens, but it's not gory.
Okay,
you could watch it. It's fascinating. It's worth.
That means I can watch it.
Yes. I mean, there's nothing in it that would be. Yeah, I mean, it's just blood.
No, it's the dripping gore from organs and beheadings
nothing like
and things. What I call gornography.
Yes, I agree.
I don't.
But there's nothing like that.
Then I will have to watch
fascinating.
It.
Fascinating. And but I watched that. I watched Star Wars. I watched Knives Out, which is
I love Knives Out.
Very light, fun entertainment. Wait a minute.
Directed by person who directed. Name another movie he directed.
You tell me. I can't recall.
Episode 8, The Last Jedi.
Still have to give me the name.
Rian Johnson is the director.
Wow, see, I do not remember people's names as much as I never really did. There were so fewer movies when I was young. There were so fewer names to recall. But he did a fabulous job with Knives Out. It worked on a number of levels. And the casting was just great. I mean, just actors having great fun showing up scenery.
And I especially
Toni Collette is hilarious.
Everybody in there, Jamie Lee Curtis, and the
she's so good.
Okay, and here's a trivia point for you: the possibly least known actor of the troupe, and it really is a great ensemble. The one who, what's exactly her job? She's the one who's the companion to Christopher Plummer. And she's really
the core, the main focus, the young.
She's the main focus of the movie. I'll throw at you, and this is like astonishing. Another role that she had in the last few years. She's Joy in Blade Runner 2049.
Oh, my God. It's been so long since I've seen that. I don't even remember who Joy was. Was
the
Joy
hologram. The hologram.
Joy the hologram. They just bruised
okay.
in my brain.
You've got to,
I'll have to look at it again.
Okay. You've got the lead. You've got the lead character who's a replicant.
Right.
And he has a hologram.
And he had a relationship with it, as I recall.
That's correct.
Yes. Okay.
That's her.
But I don't remember what she looked like because she was a hologram.
She doesn't look. Well, the poster of the movie is her.
Ah, okay.
It's him, a tiny little him with a gigantic.
The giant holographic her.
That's her. That's the same actress.
But she's great in Knives Out. She just does a very good job.
She's
being a wonderfully sympathetic character in a terribly unsympathetic position.
There's really nobody in that film that isn't really good. And the whole, you know, this is what the really poor Neil Simon takeoff on the Agatha Christie things should have been, rather than just, you know, crude Peter Sellers doing his Oriental shtick.
Well, it was very funny. They made a Clue reference, which I thought was very funny, considering the movie of Clue. Well, I saw it with Danielle. We watched the screener, and we both wanted to see it. And she was like, absolutely, let's watch that. And afterwards, I said, okay, if you like that, there's a couple other things you have to see. And one of the things I recommended to her, and you must have seen this in the day, The Last of Sheila, written by Stephen Sondheim.
I love that movie. And co-written by?
It's a similarly, same genre.
Stephen Sondheim, and he co-wrote it. Wasn't Sondheim alone.
It was Sondheim and
Anthony Perkins.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot Perkins was a co-writer on that. But that was a great film.
That's a wonderful movie.
Very much that sort of same twisted kind of whodunit sort of a thing with comedic, but a mystery at the same time.
Yeah.
And Sleuth is actually, they did a fairly good job with the movie.
Oh, I was actually waiting for, and they make a reference to Sleuth, saying, oh, now it's going to be the same person.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well,
yeah.
That's
no. Knives Out
movie.
Very coyly refers to Death Trap. It refers to Sleuth.
Yeah. Orient Express. You know. I guess we all did it.
You know. So anybody who says, "Oh, Rian Johnson doesn't know how to make movies," take a look at The Last Jedi. Wrong. He knows how to make movies. I haven't seen Looper. That was his big one. Looper.
Oh dear. Did he do Looper?
He did Looper, and he did Brick.
I have seen Brick listed and not quite gone there because Brick always sounds to me very much like Larry Clark, and Larry Clark can be a very bleak territory.
Yeah.
You know, Teenage Angst and Bully, I barely got through. It was like, good God.
Yeah.
Brick sounded like Bully again, and I didn't know if I could deal with that again.
It is
But Looper, I was not wild about. The least of which was, what the hell? How are those eyebrows supposed to look like Bruce Willis's eyebrows? But it was also just the plot. It was like timey-wimey stuff always annoys me anyway. I mean, I enjoyed Endgame despite the fact that it's one of those timey-wimey movies where it's like, if we just run back in time and get the things we need and then put everything back where it was, none of the bad things that happened to anybody will ever have happened. And they did that with one of the X-Men movies with the Days of Future Past or whatever, where Logan goes into the past to stop something, the future from being destroyed.
Whereas in the original, it was Rogue.
Yeah, we keep flashing back to the future to see them being killed one by one because once he saves the day, it's all going to be okay and none of them will have died and that future won't exist. Except having a conversation about this just the other day with somebody. If you start looking at the multiverses as splitting off when these things happen as opposed to fixing them, then technically – everybody in that X-Men movie in the future that died because that was a split off from the reality that was created when Logan fixed the thing in the past and created a new timeline where none of those things happened. But the old one was just sitting there off to the side, still rolling downhill and going into crap land while everybody died slowly and no one got restored and everything. And all that they did was fix it for somebody else, which reminds me of something else. Did you ever watch Legion?
How many shows have you and I done together about Legion?
I guess you have that. You watch the climax, spoilers, spoiler alert. But the one thing, I watched Legion. One of the things that's been bothering me is all my shows have wrapped up. So, like, Preacher's done, Legion's done. I'm waiting for new Umbrella
Next week,
Academy.
Everything is starting up again.
But Preacher won't because they wrapped out the series. It's done. Legion's done. They did the arcs. They wrapped it up. They are not planning to come back.
The Magicians is coming back.
What is coming back?
The Magicians.
Yes, but that's not one of my shows.
It needs to be.
Happy, we'll have that conversation off air. But you know, Happy did a second season. I was very happy about that. But the bottom line is these shows got wrapped up. So Legion wraps out the third season. David's the bad guy. Everyone's trying to keep him from destroying the world and time as we know it by bouncing around and destroying everything. And by the end of it, he actually accomplishes his goal. They manage to all come together. They defeat the Shadow King, who then becomes an ally, and they do all these things, and they fix it. They fix it so that David will now be raised by both his parents, Xavier and Moira, won't become schizophrenic, will be taught to use his powers, and will become a good mutant in a wonderful universe that unfolds before him.
It's very poignant the way they do it.
Yes. Now,
and what's very interesting, by the way, is that they say at the end of season two and at the beginning of season three, they tell you that this is what he was planning on doing. Guess what? He does it.
Yes, he does it. But at the point that it ended and they went to credits, I was like, oh, well, that's really nice for David. But he met Sydney in an institution where she was put after swapping bodies with her mother in the horrible incident that got her institutionalized. She's now institutionalized because that's what was happening to her on her own, independent of David. David is now not in the institution to have communication with her and lead to the events that might give her the growth that was required to get her out. So all three seasons of Legion are great for David Haller. They are crappy for Sydney because she's in the same hole that she was in, and he doesn't even remember.
And
he won't go looking for her to save her.
And not to mention Amy.
Yes.
They never resolved David's sister.
Or Sydney. You know, well, but no, but Amy would be okay. Because if David's being raised properly by both parents, so is Amy. Amy's fine now. There's no Shadow King to interrupt their life. So she doesn't die. Nothing happens to
Amy. And David was adopted, so Amy's parents are still the Hallers.
Yes. So she, well.
Oh, Amy was not adopted. David was.
Oh, that's right. But the thing is, without David being an evil, being a mutant, doing the things he's doing, he would never have been adopted by them. She would have had a perfectly normal life as a Holler, never encountered the Shadow King, never died, never had any of the
never
things.
Never met David.
Section 8 or Section 6 or whatever it was would never have come after
Division
her.
Division 6.
Her life would
Division
have been
Division
3,
actually, yeah.
Sydney's the only... Sydney and also...
Aubrey Plaza.
Aubrey Plaza's character is screwed, too, because she was a junkie in the institution as well, and she doesn't get out. So, I mean, the women don't fare well in Legion.
No, they don't.
Which I was very disappointed in. It all becomes about saving this one guy, and virtually every female character on that series totally eviscerates her own purpose, future, and life. Sydney actually gets a whole other life in season three, where she's being raised by the doctors who were like running the organization that rescued her in the first place. And she has this whole weird mystical thing in a flower pot on a landing in New York. And she learns so much.
That is such a great episode.
That was so bizarre.
The whole fairy tale episode and all that.
But she will never have that now because she never meets David. So she just rots in
the
institution
for the rest of her life. And she will also therefore never be raped by him. And
yeah, but she's probably not having a great time being institutionalized and being told she's insane she knows that she has powers and can't afford to touch anyone and lives in complete isolation. I mean, it's
okay, but we're moving away.
Yeah.
From our main focus.
As time drifts, yes.
As time drifts, because it's already 2:26.
And there's another topic that'll take the rest of the time, indeed.
We will. But so looping back a little, there have been a lot of criticisms. Why don't we play Dan Person's review of Skywalker. So yeah,
will I be able to hear it in my headphones?
You know, you should be able to because
I'm listening to Skype.
Because I'll be playing it from the same computer through which I am speaking.
Okay, I don't know if the sound from the hard drive goes into the Skype feed.
But
if your microphone is open and you keep the speakers on, I'll hear it in the background.
The speakers cannot be on when the mic is open.
Well, we'll find out.
Otherwise, there'd be a thing called feedback.
I'm not going to be able to hear it.
Well, you know what? Let me just try the very, you know, very, very first few seconds.
And just see what happens when you switch over. Okay.
Yeah, except that I have to cue.
Because I've never tried this. I have no idea if you can play music to people on Skype.
Well, that's not even... Well, I mean, what you're hearing, when you're hearing me, you're hearing, I'm talking, you know, into a board, that's going into a computer. You're hearing the output of that computer.
But the output's being put into the Skype feed that I'm listening to.
Yes.
Right.
So in theory, so let me just double click this.
If it's any sound from the computer, sure.
Hold on. Oops, and let me, and, you know, you're even on the same pot.
Okay, I'll let you know. Ended on
a tantalizing image. A young child.
I do hear him.
Okay, fine. So let's be quiet, and let me start the review from the beginning again. It seems to be at a very different level from you and I, so we'll both have to shut up, and we'll listen for 6 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, so here is the review of The Rise of Skywalker from Dan Persons. And on, I'm going to shut off my mic. You just need to be quiet. Okay, because I'm going to be boosting your volume big time. Okay.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. The previous chapter of the Star Wars saga, The Last Jedi, ended on a tantalizing image. A young child spreading the lore of Luke Skywalker among his companions and actually furtively using the Force himself. It seemed to lay the groundwork for a finale... The ultimate finale, capping a trilogy of trilogies that would set the Skywalker saga on a mythic scale, with the evil First Order finally being vanquished as the noble Jedi belief in justice and honor spread among the oppressed and across the universe.
Okay, Terrence.
I'm losing that.
Okay, hold on. Is there any way you can mute the tablet?
Well, yeah, hopefully the mic won't do it. Hang on. Yes, I can. I'm doing it now.
Okay, so...
What you're about to hear is I'm going to just push the button, and you'll hear what it sounds like when I mute it.
One second. What, Max? Can you mute his Skype? You're getting all kinds of weird... But it's on the same computer. His feed and the Skype... Oh, that's a good question.
You're getting all kinds of weird noises.
Yeah, I know it is, but hold on. Let's see if I can... Max has the idea that I might be able to mute Skype. And,
oh, interesting. Well, I can mute me if you need me to mute you.
Yeah, but Max's idea is a better one.
Okay, and, give it a shot. So I should not mute.
So at this point, yes, I let's see now. No, it mutes my microphone. It doesn't mute... Oh, wait a second. I think I saw something just now that might be yes, I believe you are now muted. Say something, Terrence.
Hello.
No, I can still hear.
Okay, I'm going to mute myself.
Okay, mute yourself. Go off and mute yourself. Okay, that sounds good. Now I can play Dan again.
Well, bleep all that. Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, can't be bothered with any of it, being instead a kind of overstuffed remake of The Return of the Jedi, which was pretty well stuffed to begin with. This, unfortunately, is one of those films that gets worse the more you think about it. That may not have been a problem for director/co-writer J.J. Abrams or anyone at Lucasfilm or Disney, since I don't think thought was their main goal, their sights set apparently on the visceral thrill of closing the Book of Skywalker in the biggest, most action-packed, most all-encompassing way possible. I guess they achieved their objective, but in the most graceless fashion imaginable. Honestly, I've never seen a panic attack on film before, but The Rise of Skywalker sure feels like one. I imagine the initial meeting where Abrams pitched his concept boiled down to him breaking out in tears and screaming, "Everything. You're going to get everything, okay? Everything's going to be in it." And then they wrote him a check and sent him on his way. And this is what we got. There's Poe and Finn and Rey and Kylo and Princess Leia, apparently through some manipulation of existing footage. And Emperor Palpatine is there. He's our big bad now. and a pretty hollow one at that. And there's an entire fleet of world killer battleships, and C-3PO, and R2-D2, and BB-8, and a new droid that's cute but exists purely for marketing reasons, and Maz Kanata, and Rose, and Jedi Ghost Luke, and an I Am Your Father beat that's much, much worse, and. It has to be hard for a filmmaker working for Disney on these mammoth franchises now, where everything has to build not just to a suitably grand culmination, but a culmination sufficiently grander than all the previous grand culminations. Rise of Skywalker has the misfortune of following hard on the heels of Avengers Endgame. And while that epic climax had its flaws, it did manage to pull all its strands together in an engaging and emotionally satisfying way. Abrams tries for that, but his operational philosophy, having taken over directing duties from Colin Trevorrow, appears to have been to tuck his head in and say, "Okay, let's just barrel through this." Not unlike what Ron Howard seemed to do when he took over Solo. I'd like to cite a specific example here, but it'd be a plot spoiler. So let me just say that it involves the death of a major character that's almost immediately rescinded. You'll know it when you see it, but it indicates Abrams trying to pull some kind of profound twist to his narrative, and clearly being pulled back by other forces. Pun not intended. The problems only get really oppressive in the third act when too many things get slapped in just because they need to be there. The Emperor's Express goals get flipped 180 degrees without explanation. Certain characters die because they have to die, while others survive because. And Abrams attempts a rousing, uplifting beat stolen directly from the Endgame script, but hasn't worked hard enough to earn the emotions it's supposed to provoke. It doesn't really help that, upon reflection, we're given very little to care about with these main characters. I was thinking about this in anticipation of this chapter. In the original trilogy, you had a good understanding of Luke and Leia and Han and Chewie, who they were and how they related to each other. There's a certain uniformity to the characters of this final trilogy. Maybe it's that they're all pretty much the same age, that their dialogue all has the same Abrams-esque snap. But the quest of Rey, played by Daisy Ridley, to discover her origins doesn't grab me the way Luke's attempts to redeem his father did, and Finn and Poe's John Boyega and Oscar Isaac, respectively, interactions don't quite click in the way Han and Chewie's did. What Skywalker has going for it is how consistently beautiful it is. The effects, and I don't think there's a shot in this film that doesn't have effects, are not just big, they're carefully composed and unleashed. The landscapes have grand scope. The action sequences are mounted so you never lose track of where you are or what's going on. That's in keeping with my thought that Star Wars Episode IX, The Rise of Skywalker, is a film meant more to be reacted to than thought about. In terms of spectacle, it's a promise kept at least. But void of any compelling narrative, that's a pretty hollow promise. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Okay, Terrence, you can now unmute yourself.
Am I back?
You are. I have to say I agree with some of the points he makes, but overall I don't agree.
Well, the history of the three films, three trilogies. Oh, this is weird. Hang on. I think I actually left you on radio in the background.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Hang on. Yes, I just have to.
There can be very little that is more confusing than hearing yourself 5 seconds later. Yeah.
Okay. There we go. Okay. 2 points. One, all three of the trilogies had the same weaknesses in the third film for reasons discussed earlier.
Yes.
It's all paying off what you set up in the first two pictures.
Yes.
So to say, oh, it's just everything we thought was going to happen, you know, it's always been everything we thought was going to happen. The other thing is to say,
this is not meant to be a surprise.
Popcorn entertainment is not nearly as flavorful and nutritious as I wanted it to be. It's frickin' popcorn entertainment. It's never going to be as deep as you want it to be.
Yeah,
and to expect it to grow up with you is foolish.
To an extent, let's just say one thing here. Martin Scorsese was right.
Well, and the thing is that it was not a judgment.
That's right.
That people jumped on him because he's saying, well, we're up here in our lofty ivory tower. We're intellectuals. We're making real films. This stuff is just stuff to fill in the seats. And yeah, but there's a purpose in that. That's why the studios made A pictures and B pictures. They made B pictures cheaply to fill in the seats. Now we make big budget B pictures. But they're the same purpose. Popular entertainment, not a lot of thought, basic moral lessons. I don't have a problem with that. The bottom line for me was
Star Wars, the way Lucas invented it is, you know, he was thinking about 1930s and 1940s movie series.
Based on an amazingly shallow, facile form of entertainment, and he made it deeper than the originals were. And they've gotten deeper over the way. Now, one of the funniest things for me, though, I had heard some vague comment that there was a same-sex kiss in this movie. And when it finally hit, I was like, that's it? That's what got all the discussion? Which takes me back to another thing, which is the complaints about the young woman who is Finn's romantic interest in the last movie who gets short shrift in this movie. It's like from the shopping list that the review just gave, how we would have fit that into this movie, too, would have been insane. I mean, there's a lot of things like that that got tossed to the side because there's so much to cram into. I do see the
problem with the expectation there, and that is that, yes, she's a major part of The Last Jedi, of Episode 8.
And thank God she was. That was a great thing, and I think she could get a movie or a series of her own.
Now, people are just, and that could happen, but people have
Which would be smart.
People have been jumping on the makers of this film for that, and they actually have come back with, and I didn't quite understand why she was so sidelined, because she is a popular character. I liked her a lot. And they gave an answer that actually makes a lot of sense. It has more to do with how you make movies than anything within the Skywalker saga.
Yeah.
And the reason that J.J. Abrams has been giving is they had to give Leia an important arc and send-off in this movie. And they had to do it by using footage cut out from the last film. And in the last film, almost every scene that Leia did that was usable to cut into this film were scenes that she had with Tran.
But the reality
is that in order to send the trio out on their big, big mission to save the saga, Leia had to be, because she was filmed at the general headquarters, and she's working with Tran. Therefore, Tran is unable to be on the adventure with the rest of them. That makes sense to me.
Well, yes, but okay. First of all, what we're saying is we're salvaging footage of her that we can repurpose to other scenes in different places in this other movie to say that Tran is peripheral to that purpose completely.
Yes.
It doesn't matter who she's talking to. The reality is there was so much jammed into this 5-pound bag to begin with that would have just been so unsatisfying and not working. The biggest confusion for me was as they're sinking into quicksand is Finn saying, I have something to tell you, and me thinking he was going to tell her that he loved her, and I'm being told that J.J. Abrams says he actually was going to tell her that he is strong in the Force, which seems like a pretty weird thing to say as you think you're dying. I have the potential to have a power that could get us out of this situation, but I don't know how to use it, to somebody who actually does know how to use it.
Yes.
And why wasn't she pulling herself out with the Force and all of them? She was blowing up ships 20 minutes later. So that's a whole other issue. But the thing is, anything they did with Tran would have just been so unsatisfying. It would have been so peripheral. It would have made the movie 3 hours long, and it wouldn't have been a satisfying relationship. I'd rather see you get more play and a spinoff story coming out of this and continuing. Part of the reality is that Tran is part of a movement to try and get people into on the screen that we recognize as ourselves. And I think that she was an important step in that. I think criticizing them for not paying it off as well as they could have in the third movie, is just going to be a mess no matter what. But to me, it was a satisfying mess. I cried in the last half hour. They hit all the typical little Disney beats. Yes, there's, spoiler. Don't anybody listen to anything coming after this out of my mouth. But yes, when Rey is, well, the funny thing is you have a scene where Rey saves Kylo and she brings him back to life and cures his wound, but also his scar and thus him, because he becomes Ben and thus a good guy.
By the way, I had one smart-ass comment about when Kylo is revealed to be alive at that point. I said, to Barbara, is this the point where Adam Driver goes up to the microphone and sings Being Alive?
No, I don't. Was he in Company? I didn't realize that.
Okay.
Was he Bobby?
You obviously haven't even been following any of the news about Marriage Story.
I have seen that it's on Netflix. I have not watched it yet. It's
okay. And
is
it's one of your screeners.
Being Alive
and,
in it?
Yes. He's singing. Okay. This is, most people know about this, including people who've never seen Marriage Story, which include me. Okay. At the end of Marriage Story, which is all about Adam Driver getting divorced from Scarlett Johansson because they have because they have drifted apart. Well, she becomes a movie actress and he's a theatrical director. And the whole,
oh my God!
And the whole,
this is like La La Land, art versus like commerce all over.
This is like every movie that Noah Baumbach has ever made.
Whatever.
All of his movies are about divorces, okay? And this
I'm talking about the specific reason for the divorce.
Okay, well, one way or the other. At the, that's not a specific reason, that's a part of it. The first four-fifths of the movie are the many reasons. But ultimately, at the end of the film, she's on one coast, he's on another. He turns out to be extremely vulnerable in the whole thing, and he's in a bar where they're doing karaoke, and her sign-off song about the divorce was "You Could Drive a Person Crazy." And his sign-off song is "Being Alive." So my joke is, when the same actor who's in like every movie that came out in the last 2 months,
I'm sure some fan editor will like combine the footage of him rising up, walking up out of the darkness, with the audio track of him singing that as. If not, we'll put that suggestion out here now. Put that up on YouTube and we'd find out.
I would be surprised if it isn't already there.
I cut a wonderful montage of Billie Eilish's Bad Guy using footage from Clockwork Orange and basically compressed the two-hour movie down into like the 3 minutes of the song, because Malcolm McDowell is the ultimate bad guy. And it worked beautifully. I can't transgress the rights to put it up anywhere.
Anyhow,
but it was
about, because we have only minutes left.
Yes, and I wanted to get to Doctor Who, but we won't. But the bottom line is, all of that is true, what he has to say. None of that didn't apply to any of the other third movies. And it's just the nature of the beast. And to say that the sugar is too sugary is disingenuous. You knew what you were eating when you opened the box. It's rice. It's not granola. It's Fruit Loops and an extra sugar, and you knew that. It's not going to be anything like that.
It ended the way I expected it to end. I loved it.
But this is the thing.
I don't think there were absolutely no surprises. In the nine movies, I would rank it right in the middle. It's not a great Star Wars film, but it's
a perfectly enjoyable 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Exactly.
And the bottom line is that there was nothing in it that I didn't expect, that I couldn't see coming, but that's been the last third movies. There's nothing in any of those third movies that you didn't expect to see. And the structure of these things has always been just the satisfaction of being vindicated. You see, I told you Ben would be a good guy at the end. The fact that Ben's body vanishes out into mist like Obi-Wan Kenobi or anybody else means that he achieved Jedi oneness by the end, and maybe popping up in spirit form with Luke at some point to drive her crazy while she's trying to have a life.
And his mother.
They're all going to be driving him crazy, driving her crazy.
And actually, so, I have one question.
And Han Solo, she's got five people all looking over her shoulder.
Okay, now you see, now that's actually the biggest spoiler of the film, isn't it?
Well, we told people there were going to be spoilers in this.
Okay, the biggest spoiler of the film, and let me ask you this, Han Solo does not...
Seriously, though, you didn't see that coming? Are you kidding me?
No, I didn't.
I mean, come on.
He doesn't...
Okay, 1,000 miles away.
One second. He doesn't have the Force.
It's not an issue with that. It's crappy emotionality and sentimentality. Well, it's Rey being dead with her eyes open and lying there, and Ben sacrificing the Luddite.
No. I'm not talking about that.
That he literally just got from her.
I'm not talking about that.
What are you talking
about? I was talking about Han Solo. Harrison Ford.
And I'm saying, yes, and I'm saying that it has... What I'm saying is that his return... And spoiler... His return in this in spirit form is totally within the realm of the sentimentality that drives these movies. Regardless of whether or not he has the Force within him, he was around people enough that he's able to do this. You could say Ben has the Force, and that's what called his father back to give him guidance at a moment of crisis.
Oh, that's
but
not
really?
Bad. That's...
You didn't think Han Solo's ghost wasn't making a return engagement? I knew that was coming. But the bottom line is, and to me, that's this, what I was saying is, Ren's what Daniel calls the revocation of death, you know, revoking her death by the same means she had just used to revoke his death, because we establish it when she starts healing people,
right,
that she can do this. She then saves him, diminishes her life force somewhat, but not enough to kill her. He's back alive again. But evidently she only gave him enough to save one person, and it turned out to be her. So it's like, but again, how did you not see Ben's self-sacrifice to save the day and his redemption not being that? I mean, my God, it makes me feel like I've got to change something in my third novel because I have a character doing virtually the same thing. And I'm getting sick of self-sacrifice to save the day. I've got to look at that again.
But I agree with you, because I want to move on to who is so do you. But I agree with you, basically, that if you're going to order a confection of sugar, it's going to be sweet.
Yeah, it's going to be overly sweet at times, too.
And you knew that
going
when you ordered it.
Exactly. And the bottom line is, there's nothing wrong with confection. I needed confection that night. The perfect thing to watch on a down night while I was feeling a little low. It
absolutely
raised my spirits.
I wept.
I got out toxic chemicals. It was fabulous.
Talk about, you know, opera.
That said, I don't disagree with anything that the review says. Absolutely. He's right on all that. That's not the point of why this was made, though. It was never going to be something that's going to make everybody happy. And the only thing people are complaining about is this stuff that got left out because we had so much other crap jammed into it.
Yeah, and as it is for a Star Wars movie, it's almost overly complicated.
And it's basically saying, where's the sprinkles on my 6-layer double chocolate sundae, you know, cake with the 5 gallons of ice cream, whipped cream, cherries? I wanted sprinkles too.
Okay.
It's like, seriously?
Okay. So and the only one thing that I'm worried about, and this is something that obviously happened on the corporate level at Disney, at Lucasfilm.
Yes.
Films,
well, look forward to more.
Is that they are giving there were a lot of toxic idiots talking about Rian Johnson's film The Last Jedi, because they couldn't deal with the fact that it was female empowerment and stuff like that. And there's very, very, very few people that composed those people, but they were also very, very vocal. They were also able to manipulate the Rotten Tomatoes score and things like that. And while this was a movie all about fan service, they also did, I think, a little too much fan service for the toxic fans.
Well, you know, but that's industry, and that's why it's Disney, and that's why it's show business, and
but you know,
that's why
those people,
Martin Scorsese makes cinema, whereas these are movies. Takes risks.
Scorsese has also made just movies. Think Hugo.
Absolutely. No, I'm not saying he hasn't, and I don't think he would deny that at all. But I think that he also, but he puts it in a different category.
Yeah.
Doctor Who.
We've
got 5 minutes left.
We have 5 minutes left. The first part of the two-parter season opener, season 12 of the rebooted Doctor Who, starring Jodie Whittaker, was on earlier tonight. And part two will be on Sunday night, which will then be its usual slot.
Yes, yeah, so technically there wasn't a New Year special. They just premiered it on New Year.
No, it was.
It was the first of two parts of a standard series episode. It wasn't a Christmas-themed or New Year's-themed episode. It was,
and by the way,
the beginning of the new season.
Rewatched a little of last year's New Year's special called it was awful.
Resolution?
Resolution.
Yeah, I thought that was the new one. I accidentally paid for it and got it canceled. Well, I don't remember it very well, which never bodes well. But, you know, the bottom line is you didn't like this one. I did. But I will admit something right up front. I have, except for that one terrible, terrible sleepwalking episode of found footage written by the guy who worked with him on Sherlock. I can't remember the actor's name. He plays M. But he wrote the most god-awful episode of Doctor Who in the history of the series.
He plays M?
Yes, on Sherlock. He plays the brother. Not the, no.
Mycroft,
yes,
not M. Mycroft.
But
yes, Mark Gatiss. Yes, does not play M.
Yes, but Gatiss wrote this episode in one of the Peter Capaldi seasons.
And
where
it
was like
one.
All found footage, and it was people falling asleep, and it was dreadful. And at the end of it, it was like, this is a viral video, and you watching it means now you're infected. And it was all a plot just to do this so the doctor would play for everybody. It was awful.
And
every
by the way, we need to point
awful.
Out that near the end of this month, I think, or else next month, the Sherlock team, Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat, are premiering their new Dracula.
Oh, dear. Well, considering how they managed to like pretty much ruin Sherlock for me in the last season.
It was such a wonderful show.
At the point they killed his wife, it went right downhill.
They wiped their excrement all over it.
It just went right downhill. So we'll see where it all goes. But other than that, truthfully, I don't know that there's a Doctor Who made I haven't liked. I find the series to be the most successful format in the history of television. I think the character is fascinating and just wonderfully messianic in a very perverse way. Rick and Morty appeals to me because it's basically Doctor Who on crack, you know. But the thing is that I like this one because of the reasons you didn't like it. You didn't like the Bondian underpinnings of the whole thing. I thought that was great fun.
It wasn't underpinnings. It was that they took it too far.
But the thing is, it was part one, and they'll undo that by part two. Oh, my God. So tell me, here's the thing that blew me away. Am I crazy, or was that Lenny Henry playing the villain?
That was Lenny Henry playing the villain.
I was watching the episode, and I'm watching and going, this guy's really good. And it wasn't until a close-up, and they got close
Hold
enough
on.
That I could
Hold
see his
on.
Eyes behind Sorry. The glasses. And it was a wonderful performance. I love that they cast him for that part.
No,
I haven't seen him in ages, and I loved how villainous he was.
Let me tell you something. He was very good. I would have preferred him in the other villainous role.
Well, that would have been very fun.
Wonderful in that other role?
Absolutely. Yes, because I think so. That would have been very interesting. He would have done it beautifully.
I'm disappointed that we waited so many years for Stephen Fry, he's been promised to be on the show since season two, and he's on for 90 seconds.
I was like, God damn it. What the hell? I want him back. I know. Has Hugh Laurie been on Doctor Who yet?
No.
You've got to get him on there.
Stephen Fry has been asking to write episodes of Doctor Who. He has been campaigning almost as much as John Barrowman.
Who?
Yes.
Who?
Yes.
Wants to write for the series. Don't be funny.
Stephen Fry.
Well, yes. Fry and Laurie should team up and do an episode. I mean, the two of them, that show is
well,
still
there, hilarious. There is a reference to Fry and Laurie, a big gaping reference. In this episode of Who, if you've watched a bit of Fry and Laurie, four seasons,
all of which, yes.
they do a number of parodies of the John le Carré, Alec Guinness, smiley things, right?
Yes. Oh, those are hilarious.
And who does Stephen Fry play in those?
Oh, I can't quite recall. I haven't seen them in years.
C.
Oh, so the character...
C for control.
There was a character called C in the episode?
Yes, Stephen Fry.
I thought he was M.
He's C.
Oh, there was some joke about it, too. Okay, well, that makes sense then. But
he's not M, he's C. I told you, there is no M.
I understand what you're saying. Well, it's M6, so it gets very confusing, all these damn acronyms and letters and things and Brits, whatever. But no, I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun.
And P.S., one thing that really annoyed me in this?
Yeah.
There is no unit, there is no Torchwood. What happened to them?
Oh, they got wiped out. When did they get wiped out? Did you not watch the Torchwood series? They all got killed except for Captain Jack and the woman who came on in the first episode.
Okay, where's
the unit? They went their separate ways. So Torchwood died with the series.
I remember. Yes and no.
And then they did the movies that they came have afterwards, actually but revived, essentially Torchwood
they've revived gone. Torchwood in Big Finish.
Unit, I thought, was still functioning with the daughter of Brigadier General.
Played by Gemma Redgrave.
The last time we saw them, but could they have killed them off in the episode with all the Cybermen?
Danny Pink episode? They have never indicated that. Never, ever.
So in that case, they just sort of threw that in there as a backstory thing that happened between seasons, unless they put it into one of the books
But those aren't canon. Listen, this show ended 2 minutes ago.
Okay, well, it's been fun. Yeah. People should read my reviews in Nightmare Magazine. The new one just came out. And go to Nightmare Magazine and read my reviews. I worked very hard.
Nightmare-magazine.com.
Yeah.
And listen to the podcast.
And there are many other fun things to hear as well, like the picture.
Yes, and Lightspeed, of course, because I work on both.
Indeed.
Okay. Terrence Taylor, thank you.
Thank you. I'll talk to you anon.
Okay, very, and on and on and on.
No, dear. Hey, you had to do that at the end.
I did.
You had to spoil it all.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Have a good morning. Okay, so let's see. There we are. Okay, this is working now. Lister is here. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers coming to this station in but a few seconds. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you all for listening. Be good to each other. I will be back next week from 1 to 3. So have a good morning and week and Happy New Year and all that good rot. Take care. Okay, Lister says, just started over again. Thing is, I killed the app, and I closed the darn thingy. So let me see. There it is. Bear with us, folk. There's Sails of Silver, and we're going to pick it up, actually.
too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria, trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledged allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, or that's my right in this writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
After 3 o'clock, flat burning time right here. 99.5 WBAI at its very best right here. Lister on the radio, burning the impudous red, white, and blue to ashes with no apology right here. I'd like to dedicate this track to Grayson, my man, and his entire family. How much we appreciate what you do, and they don't want to tell you that.
Feel your heart of stone, got no soul. Want I to take me what I own. But trust them far as the blind can see. Chant them down, chant them down. Heart of stone. Me say them got no soul. But trust them far as blind man can see. Blind can see. Chant them down. Transfer to other lands. Drawing out. Drawing out plans. Results into evil deeds and destruction. Who feels it and sees it, dislike it and curse it, get bumped off. Who feels it and sees it, dislike it and curse it, get bumped off. Oh, 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 oh. License to kill. Tell your brother, heart of stone, got no soul. One type of dead to what I own. But trust as much as the dead can eat. Can't talk. Chant them down. Corrupted lives are lives we don't wish to leave. The fruits of peace is what we love to. Love to pick and eat. We see it, we intend to plant and grow. Oh, you don't like what I and I might have to say so. You bump by your
Get the
but just as much as the dumb game.